So you're in the creative writing program.
Uh-huh.
Do you know Robert Stubblefield?
He's such a cool guy. I didn't know Robert Stubblefield, but his fan club of nominally ambitious 30-year-old straight men convinced me that I should meet him. So at the Susan Cheever reading, I introduced myself, told him how the guys I date seemed to love him, and by mid-reception, I too had become convinced. He is such a cool guy. Robert received his MFA from the University of Montana in 1992, where he now teaches fiction, advanced composition, and is the faculty advisor for the Oval. He has published fiction and personal essays in Dreamers and Desperados, Contemporary Short Fiction of the American West, Hayden's Ferry Review, Left Bank, The Clackamas Literary Review, Cascadia Times, Oregon Humanities, Open Spaces, Oregon Salmon, Essays on the State of the Fish at the Turn of the Millennium, and High Desert Journal, among others. His story, Preserves, is published in Best American Short Stories of the West, and he was named a top University of Montana professor by the Missoulian Reader's Choice Awards. Robert also facilitated a mean panel discussion on literary magazines at this year's Festival of the Book, and he's proved invaluable in planning the upcoming Cupping event, a reading of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Please join me in welcoming Robert Stubblefield.
Thank you, and thank all of you for coming out tonight. Can you hear me okay? Of course, I'd like to thank the Top Hat for welcoming us again tonight and all semester and throughout the past couple of years, and also my friends, colleagues, and students who are here tonight, and Beth and BJ for putting this together, and Sam for reading with me. And if any of you are considering Christmas shopping for me, I think I'd kind of like a glass harmonica. So, and I'd especially like to thank the Oval students who are here tonight, who spent the weekend participating in a new class offering, which is Wildland Urban Interface Ecology for English majors, which some people call leaf raking and brush piling. And tonight I'm going to read an excerpt from a new essay titled Wrecks and Shells. And this is the closing essay in my collection, The Country of Your Hands, which I'm sending out in a couple of weeks. And I hesitate to say that it's about hauntings because, as some of you might know, within my household, I'm not exactly the authority on hauntings and things of that nature. But I guess this is for Deborah then. And I don't think it requires much explanation, or it would require more explanation than that I can give. This is pretty much the final third of the essay, and it deals with these spaces and places that kind of enchant us as children, and then we try to figure out why maybe later. The next wreck was initially no wreck at all, but a gift. A fully operable 1951 Willys wagon presented to my father by his friend Chuck Vendetta. Chuck was in the late stages of terminal lung cancer and had been a longtime friend of my father's. They raised young families together, worked side by side, felling timber and splitting fence posts, played town team baseball, drank beer, camped, fished. My father didn't appear altogether thrilled with the gift of the Willys on the day of delivery. Chuck wanted to know where to park it, and my father maintained that Chuck didn't really want to part with the Jeep, but Chuck insisted, saying that none of his kids wanted it, and that my father could use it for parts for our Willys pickup, if nothing else. Chuck told my father that they'd had a lot of good times traveling in that Willys, and he wanted him to have it. Those good times were at the root of my father's hesitation. To recognize and categorize good times is to somehow firmly and irrevocably plant them in the past. Maybe Chuck did this out of necessity, and there was no small amount of courage in his demeanor and offer. I don't believe my father was prepared for any of it, for accepting Chuck's prognosis, for the generosity, for the courage, for the acknowledging or accounting. I'd heard many the tale of the good times in Net Willie's, of our families combined for 4th of July camping trips along the North Fork, of the hunting trips with the Vandetta boys and my older brother. These memories preceded my existence. My brother Jim is 11 years older than me. He'd been one of the youngest on these camping trips. Stories of squabbling children, laughing adults, the bubbling spring filled with ice-cold beer, didn't match with my middle-aged, overworked, and sometimes exhausted parents. A part of me was jealous of those good times, those young and apparently carefree parents, and perhaps that factored into, as much as anything can factor into a 9-year-old's decision, the ill-fated choice I made regarding Net Willie's. I think my father believed that late August afternoon might be the last time he would see Chuck in this world, which turned out not to be the case, as my father drove to Prairie City to visit him several times before Chuck's death. But the daily sight of that Willie's refuted any hope that Chuck remained loose in the world. There were interchangeable parts from the Willie's that we could have used, but my father couldn't bring himself to strip a door handle, a side view mirror, even a heater knob. Eventually, a decade after Chuck's death, my father allowed a team of brothers to remove the powertrain from the Willie's in exchange for 2 cords of firewood. He offered the Willie's to Chuck's family, but none of them wanted it. Chuck and Choicey had divorced years before all of this. Both remarried, and my parents remained friendly with them, but their orbits scattered, and they would never again share those moments of raising a young family, the children running and laughing and wrestling along the perimeter of a makeshift campground. The Willie's became a shell and remains on our family property. My own memories of Chuck's Willie's wagon do not involve camping trips nor family outings, but instead a lesson about being a follower rather than my own person, about deferring responsibility for my actions, and how that in no way offers absolution. My visiting cousins, bored teenage boys with 22 rifles and a brick of shells, collectively the bane of any sign maintenance man, stray cat, or passing songbird. I was 9 or 10 and not unfamiliar with firearms. I was entrusted with my brother's single-shot J.C. Higgins 22, and occasionally, under proper supervision, my grandfather's bold-action Winchester repeating 22. I mowed lawns, raked leaves, and pulled weeds to save for a gun of my own, stashing bill and coin alike in a cedar box as I weighed the merits of the more versatile varmint-killing 22 or a 410 shotgun to pursue quail during the fall. I shot the 22 at targets, at belt and ground squirrels in dryland alfalfa fields, and occasionally carried it along on deer hunting trips with my father, although I wasn't allowed to shoot. I would take the Oregon Hunter's Safety course before I was 12, then be eligible to purchase a hunting license and deer tag. I anticipated this rite of passage for numerous reasons. Hunting season was one of the few times that my father took time away from chores to pursue pleasure. Not that he denied himself throughout the remainder of the year. He always had time to have a beer and share an afternoon visit with Joe Elder or to host visiting friends or relatives, but he never took the heart of the day like he did during those opening weekends of deer season. Irrigation season closed October 1st. Haying was completed and the beef cattle remained on the range. Morning and evening milkings, feeding and watering the horses, these tasks were constant. But those first few weekends in October were devoted to deer hunting and watching the World Series in the afternoon after returning. These weekends provided me glimpses of who my father had been and remained when afforded the opportunity. He smiled more, worried less, and surrounded by family and the closest of friends, took a complete pleasure that was somehow partial and guarded during the remainder of the year. Too often for my liking, stories were suffixed with, "That was before you were born." Today, I hold a deeper appreciation for pre-Robert stories, and would willingly hear them recounted on Joe's shady back patio, but I'm no longer 9 years old. On those summer days, I wanted to be home instead of listening to days gone by. Maybe I wanted to be out of Monument entirely. It's predictable and even unfair to blame television in full, but I don't recall being bored before television. Initially, it seemed to almost enhance or validate our rural lives. We watched television on special occasions at my grandmother's house. Bonanza and the Wonderful World of Disney were my favorites, and they still held their allure when the Zenith console finally entered our own home. Sunday evening still makes me long for my mother's roast beef and dark gravy, brown beans, and homemade biscuits. But soon, too soon, television caused me to question our lives in a way that I previously hadn't. The house that architect Mike Brady designed for his family, the Partridge Family Bus, those seemed locales where exciting things happened, where interesting people belonged. Pre-adolescent life in a small town, any life in any town for that matter, can become predictable, solid under the best of circumstances. An arc becomes visible and appears inevitable. It's the lullaby leaving us certain we will come of age and marry our third grade teacher or our first classmate crush. We realize that we do have some control over that life and then attempt to seize the reins fitfully. Or we recognize the sway of outside influences and act as we fear we might have even absent those influences. In my case, my cousins. Wandering the foothills with their new 22s, shooting first targets, then pursuing out-of-season quail, feral cats, fence posts, glass power line insulators. Every thrill immediate, then all too quickly dampened and muted by repetition. And after a morning of such aimless mischief, we walked the dusty gravel driveway. And there, over by the dike along the river, they spotted the green willies. "I'll bet you can't shoot that window out," the oldest said. Immediately on high alert, I knew a bad idea when presented one, but didn't speak up until the younger of the two sighted down the barrel. "I don't think we should do that," I said. "Why?" the oldest said. "It's nothing but an old wreck." I didn't answer, but even then I knew that it was much more than an old wreck, but instead a repository, an artifact. I sensed the avoidance of my father's gaze when we drove past it on the tractor haying, when he had instructed me to swing the line of the sprinkler so the water droplets wouldn't bead against the side panels and roof. We'd applied the same logic to the shop, a gray weathered board and batten 18 by 18 foot building that we strategically placed empty 25 gallon barrels beside the sprinklers to protect. Panels of midday sunlight burst through spaces the size of my hand, but the shake roof remained surprisingly sound against rainfall. The willies was left to the weather, but we didn't add to the onslaught. Benign neglect, I suppose. The first bullet was low for the window, but popped against the door. "That looks just like Bonnie and Clyde's car," the older brother said. "There, look, Clyde's head just popped up." Arthur Penn's Bonnie and Clyde had been released several years earlier, and my cousins had seen it and apparently been powerfully influenced. My father had chaperoned an overnight trip for my brother's class and had wished to see Bonnie and Clyde, but instead had accompanied the boys to see Planet of the Apes, which he considered a waste of time. And then the reenactment was on. Bullets pinged, glass shattered, a brief outbreak of silence, then emptied magazines. I'm not hedging when I tell you I honestly can't recall firing the J.C. Higgins. My cousin's bullets had already shattered every window facing our side. Initially, I'd felt privileged to be included in their wanderings, while they were indifferent to having me along, and occasionally even attentive to me in the way you glance into an adjoining room from time to time to make certain nothing interesting is taking place. But during the past few days, I'd become bored with them and was ready to return to my own daydreaming and activities. Maybe I'd begin to suspect that my own role was somewhat that of a reporter. Okay, tattletale. I'd already learned one lasting lesson regarding guns and the choices confronted when holding one. The daisy was a present for my 7th birthday. And I pocked paper targets taped to cardboard boxes, plinked tomato and peach cans, but soon grew bored with stationary, inanimate targets. The arc of the BB leaving the barrel was visible, so shooting birds was iffy business. I tried the clustered quail, wished for the house swallows to leave the sanctuary of the porch eaves rather than darting in and out, and then one day, the solitary robin perched atop the left of the twin 7-foot gateposts. I aimed high, rested against the corner post of the porch, and had an instant to be dumbfounded as the robin remained stationary, the poofed of the release compression, the brassy and traceable arc of the BB, the slight rustling and parting of the bird's breast feathers, all in slow motion. The robin fell, fluttered one wing, and then stilled. A momentous vacuum passed, and my father's soft footfalls rounded the corner of the house. There are appropriate responses, or responses that at least temporarily feel appropriate, to most emotions directed our way. Anger can be deflected or reflected with anger in kind. Jealousy, founded or unfounded, can be turned. But the face of disappointment withers and deflates all possible responses. Why would you want to kill a robin, my father asked. What did an old robin ever do to you? The answer was, of course, that I didn't wish to kill the robin. I wished to shoot at it, to demonstrate my marksmanship. And I had. For some reason, I thought that at least some part of my father would be proud. I can't say that I never again shot at songbirds. A lesson truly learned requires applied vigilance and practice for an indeterminate period. But I never again shot a songbird without considering that day, and eventually, shooting non-game birds or animals lost its appeal. My cousins left immediately after the shootout to go spend time with our relatives in town. I knew that my father would discover the shatter and spiderweb windows, the fresh bullet holes in the doors and side panel, but I didn't expect the discovery to be immediate. But he paid more attention to that Jeep on a daily basis than I'd believed. I saw him walk across the field in the late afternoon light. He paused 10 feet away from the Jeep, then slowly approached. Disgust and bewilderment were evident in his posture, even from 150 yards away. I don't recall my father asking me if I had shot at the Jeep. He did ask why I'd let those boys do that, then ask of himself or me or no one in particular why they would want to do that. I would have preferred to have passed it off as being young, being under their influence, to have deflected any responsibility or culpability. Even then, I realized that wasn't an option. The act violated several ideals close to my father's heart: caring for your property, not squandering or wasting your resources. I'd been taught those lessons over any number of acts: leaving the back porch light on, running water while I brushed my teeth, lessons I paid attention to and then summarily heeded, forgot, or ignored. Chuck was my friend, and he gave me that Jeep in hopes I'd get some use out of it, my father said. The three words that stuck with me, that stick with me to this day, are Chuck, friend, and hope. And inherent in those words, in the phrase, was trust, and that's what I'd violated. I couldn't have prevented them from shooting up the vehicle, but I could have walked away. I didn't need to condone what they had done by witnessing or being thrilled. Did I shoot at the window? Did I purposely aim high, trying to fool them into believing that I was participating? Or did I just give myself over to watching the bullets fly and the glass shatter? All of these possibilities seem equally likely, and no one more condemning nor consoling than another. Just because you're younger than them doesn't mean you have to put up with a thing like that, my father said. You know what is right. Why do you think they ran off? You know better. He suggested I put my brother's .22 away for a while, and I did. I didn't listen to my cousins as carefully, no longer believe they delivered any news from a bigger or better world. And into my 20s and even 30s, I had trouble walking by the Jeep, averting my eyes as I passed while irrigating her hay. To fail to empathize is not by definition to fail to identify. Occasionally, we notice a part of ourselves in someone else, and not necessarily a part we embrace. It's evident in the way school kids battle to distinguish themselves from their peers who are most similar. Those who should naturally share an allegiance cultivate bitter grudges and battle fiercely over insignificant turf. Perhaps all meanness is nothing more than an absence of empathy. And perhaps that is what the shattered windows and splintered boards illustrate, nothing more than petulant rage against the growing awareness that our domicile, weathered and unkept as it may become, will outlive us. "Look on my works, ye mighty, in despair," Shelley wrote. And then, round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. Again, it is that battle of hubris and foreboding that is most evident and closest to the surface during adolescence, but remains throughout our lives. How do we set forth on anything unfamiliar without the internalized boast that we are unique? Then we have at least a singular word to add to the great conversation. We alternately desecrate and honor the past, the material efforts of parents and predecessors. We listen to and heed warnings and admonishments, and then set out filled with energy and desperation to prove them wrong. And when the dust motes glitter in the light filtering through smoked glass, leaking down from the shaked roofs, when the crows scatter from crumpled DeSotos and Model Ts, from the ridgelines of one-room schoolhouses and board and batten houses, it is easy to believe that those efforts were not squandered, that the remaining questions are enough, the mere fact that anyone at all is left to wonder, if not despair. We seldom have the luxury of choosing artifacts we truly respond to, and collective response is somehow both mandated and muted. Instead, we tear up at the mundane and oftentimes dismiss the grand with a cursory, touristy glance. When we do respond, what is the lesson? Perhaps only to remain fearless without becoming heedless. We risk repeated backward glances, simultaneously awed, silenced, coddled, and kindled by these wrecks and shells. Thank you.